David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 388. I'm your lunar conscious host, Steve Raker, waxing and waning around the spring equinox as we ring in a season, or two, of warmer weather here in the Northeast states. Andrew and Kevin will be along in a few, and we'll discuss the online Spider-Man 60th anniversary event from this winter, and then delve into our next batch of issues from the 90s Mark Spector Moon Knight series, with issues 15 to 21. Marvel Noise is the semi-monthly podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. Our scope is all things Marvel, with a particular fondness for and fascination with the Bronze Age, and the ongoing exploits of Bronze Age characters. You can find, listen to, stream, and download episodes past and present over on MarvelNoise.com. Get new episode announcements, give us feedback, and see images and cover galleries on our Facebook and Twitter pages, and find other fine podcasts from our benevolent host, Derek Howard, and his Deliberate Noise Network, which include Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show where we talk indie comics. Now, before I bring on the guys, it's kind of customary for the host to share a recent read or two to recommend. Let's see here. How about Conan the Reaver, a Marvel graphic novel from 1987, after they stopped numbering the Marvel graphic novels. This one's written by Don Carr, two A's, with art by John Severin and his sibling Mirthful Marie Severin on colors. In this one, Conan's a thief. He's the leader of the Thieves Guild in Turan, and through the bribing of a palace guardsman, more like, I won't kill you if, he joins the ranks of the king's guardsmen, witnesses sacrificed to a tentacled monster in a pit for those who are disloyal to the king, and sees the king's enormous treasure chamber firsthand that the king barely acknowledges or visits. Conan wants it so bad. The king recognized both Conan's sense of honor and his skill with a sword, but also his capacity for treachery, and catches him in the act and makes a deal with Conan to protect his young wife when things go sideways. Sure enough, things do. And then Conan has to juggle seeking the treasure, fulfilling his bargain, and of course facing the thing in the pit, all gloriously rendered by a true master illustrator in John Severin. I'm not sure anybody draws leather and metal armor and swords at work like Severin does. It makes up for the less than smooth narrative, but a great ride overall. In fact, I'll be reading Conan's other Marvel graphic novels in coming weeks, and by Crom, I'll be sure to share them with you. All right, now let me get on Andrew the L.A. Rabbit and WWX Kevin. Spider-Man. All right, Kevin, Andrew and I have to tell you about the beyond amazing 60 years of Spider-Man invitation-only web event for Marvel Unlimited subscribers thing.
Steve, I wouldn't push that invitation-only stuff too hard. Uh-huh. I don't feel it was perhaps the most exclusive event in town, but
no, but they made you register.
Yeah, yes, there were some things, but I do like how, you know, this ultra deluxe only real fans allowed event.
Well, Kevin doesn't know, so we could tell, you know, how we present it can really shape his reality here.
That seems very ethical.
You know, when you lean out and you say to the guys that are in line outside the club, oh, this is so awesome in here.
You guys were influencers and you got in?
So it was hosted by Lorraine Sink, which the whole time I thought she was Lorraine Stink because they never put her name up, but it's Sink.
She does a bunch of a couple of the podcasts and their live events. They sometimes for some of the conventions will run stream from their booth. And she is one of the rotating hosts of that as well. So in the recent pandemic, I watched some of their, you know, show events, or if it's a show I'm not going to and they're streaming. So I'm a bit more familiar, but I did not know her name either, Steve.
Stan Lee is someone's screen name.
Hello, Marvel.
No, Agent M.
Beyond Amazing, celebrating 60 years of Spider-Man, presented by Marvel Unlimited. I'm your host, Lorraine Sink, and I'm beyond excited to celebrate with you. A big welcome to all of you Marvel Unlimited subscribers and Marvel insiders. Thank you for joining us.
That's me.
We are completely live for this event, and we have the great honor of kicking off the 60th anniversary celebrations for one of the most beloved characters in comic book history. There is so much wonderful stuff to come tonight, and to kick it off with a bang, here is an exclusive Marvel Insider code for 20,000 points right down. Only 5,000 people can redeem it, so don't miss out. Check it out also in the giveaways tab. You'll also have...
But then I have to do things with my points.
Throughout the event, which you can
they get. Always remind me. They always want me to do things with my points, and I'm like,
giveaways. Check out the giveaways tab for more information on all.
I've gotten a few posters or comics, but 99% of it's garbage.
Yeah, I don't need a new screensaver. Yeah. So considering like the classic four window mosaic of a Zoom group chat setup. This was structured as being four segments where she was one of the squares and then three guests would form a panel and they would have a little discussion and do some giveaways along the way. Like there was a free NFT comic download and there was a Silk Marvel Legends Amazon exclusive figure debut. They announced a 6-issue Infinity comic related to the Spider-Verse and some Funko Pop giveaways, that kind of thing.
Oh, that sounds pretty enticing.
It was long though, Kevin, like almost two and a half hours long.
Remember, I went to that nerdy 30 Deadpool thing and that was pretty long too.
Yeah, this was a lot like that from what you guys told me about that. The first panel was Beyond Sensational, looking at the origins of Spider-Man. And here we had J.M. DeMatteis, Tom Brevoort, and Steve Wacker, which was kind of cool, right? And talking about how Spidey's so relatable.
Including Kraven's Last Hunt and the new Ben Reilly Spider-Man series, J.M. DeMatteis. Hey, J.M.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Mark. Good to have you. Former Spider-Man editor and former co-executive producer of the Spider-Man animated series, my old boss, Steve Wacker. Hi.
Hey.
Yay.
And VP and executive editor, Tom Reamer. Hey, Tom.
Hillary, how you doing?
I'm great. Thank you all for joining me. Now, we are going to be looking into the legacy of Spider-Man into the early days.
I've never seen an upshot of Brevoort. Because whenever I see him, it's in person. I'm always looking down on him.
Original Spider-Man comics from Stan Lee.
Everybody dressed up today.
Yeah, no, that's serious.
You kick us off.
He buttoned the buttons almost all the way up.
The first Spider-Man comic I remember seeing was a really, really early one. And I was used to the finely sculpted, pristine, somewhat sterile comics from the Distinguished Competition. And I thought Spider-Man was a horror comic. Because I had never seen anything like Steve Ditko's work. Spider-Man, if you look at those old comics especially, is very creepy. And in fact, as a kid at that age, it was a little too creepy for me, so I had to kind of back away from it. I wasn't ready for it. But then a few years later, I jumped on right when John Romita took over the book and then went back and reread all those original stories. But I think the essence of Spider-Man was right there in that first Romita story that I read, which is you had a huge, huge story on with the Green Goblin, with Peter Parker, but there were no, the stakes weren't about the world. The stakes were all personal. It was about Peter Parker. It was about Norman Osborn. It was about Harry Osborn. It was about their families. And Spider-Man has always been a profoundly personal character rooted in really emotional emotional stories of some psychological depth. And that's what I responded to as a kid, and that's what I responded to as a writer.
Yeah, I really think
Mark DeMatteis is good people.
Steve, how about you?
You know, he's an everyman and all that.
Spider-Man was the first superhero who was the audience that all the superheroes up to that point were, as JF said earlier, you know, these fairly aspirational, finely chiseled, full-grown, upstanding citizens. And Peter Parker was just this stupid kid trying to make something good out of this weird accident that happened to him. And often lousing up in the way he did it, and it not being, just a blessing or a boon to him, or the thing that puts him over the top and makes everybody love him, but in fact that complicates his life and makes it more difficult. And, you know, speaking personally,
right, because it's hard to be us.
If you gave me superpowers, I would be awful with them. I would just be bad at it. And Spider-Man was often bad at it. And that, I think, was very relatable.
Well, I definitely think that we all feel a real kindredness with Peter Parker in particular.
Is that a word?
This is a person. And
kindredness?
You probably know him better than anyone, as you spent so much time writing Spider-Man in the psyche of Spider-Man. What early stories really inspired?
I feel like I'm sitting in a college class with you, and I'm like, making me comments. This is what it was like to be in class with me. This is why me and my friends were like nicknamed Waldorf and Sattler, sitting in the back.
Some of my best friends
in grad school.
I have lived inside their heads, and I know every little demon that's crawling around in their psyches. My friends don't let me do that, you know. So, you know, at first as a reader and then as a writer, I've lived with this character my entire life. And I would say that, you know, to follow up what Tom said, you know, these stories are always about Peter Parker, mask on or mask off. They're not Spider-Man stories. They're Peter Parker stories. And Peter, to me, in terms of mainstream comics, is the most psychologically real character that's ever emerged from mainstream comics. You know, he doesn't put on a mask and become something other. He's always Peter. And another thing to go back to what we talked before, he was a working class kid too. He was a working class kid from Brooklyn. I really related to that. He wasn't some rich guy, or you know, he was just a kid whose family was struggling. And all these things. I mean, if you talk to any Spider-Man writer, I don't care what their ethnicity is, what their religion, what their background, we all feel like he's us. You know, and it's a very unique thing for a character to be able to be that relatable to so many different people. If that answered your question, I don't know.
No, yes.
So, rapid fire, Kevin. The most sinister Spider-Man villain.
Most sinister is Venom.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. Spider-Man's greatest love interest?
Mary Jane.
Oh, Kevin. Wheat cakes.
How about Spider-Man in one word?
Responsibility.
Ooh, that's a good one. I was going to say Spidey. But with DeMatteis there, they kind of veered off the script a little bit and fired around of what their favorite JMD Spidey story was, which led them to talk a little bit about like Kraven's Last Hunt and the spectacular 200 with the Harry dying as the Green Goblin and all that.
Yeah, that's one of those marking posts along the way of issues that I would definitely remember reading and talking about and something sort of like a Daredevil 300 type of thing where it's like, well, you don't have that many comics to buy, right? So, I mean, some of those issues are embedded in your brain there.
A modern masterpiece for sure.
Now we have some fan questions here from our friends that are watching here right now. We have this one from Patrick in Canada for JM. Spectacular Spider-Man 200 is my favorite Spider-Man comic. When you kill a major character, what's that?
That's a good comic.
It is.
Right.
When you kill a major character like Harry Osborn, do you need permission from the other Spidey writers, or can you just like kill him and the other writers go, oh, I guess he's dead now?
Come on. That was during the editorial driven years. It was all
every other writer you certainly need the permission of your editor. You know, in most cases, and I've killed off a few of these characters in one way, you know, it's just, you know, you don't even, it's not like you sit down. I didn't sit down 2 years before that when I launched that story and said, I'm going to kill Harry. It was a natural evolution of the story. And my editor, Danny Fingeroth, understood that. The one time we had to really go up above was when it was time to kill Aunt May, and we had to get Stan's permission on that, because we couldn't do that without Stan's permission. But usually it's just between you and your editor. And if the other writers have complaints, they don't complain to me, they complain to the editor.
The second panel was beyond spectacular, looking at Spidey's design and visual impact. And here we had Joe Quesada, Umberto Ramos, and John Romita Jr.
Now back.
And of course, yeah, right? They, of course, discussed that. And with the design, the three of them were all about Spidey's eyes, right? And how much they like to manipulate the eyes on that mask.
Through all his various incarnations, these creators are some of the most iconic illustrators to bring Peter Parker's stories to life. First up, we have artist and Marvel Entertainment's artistic director, Joe Quesada. Hey, Joe.
Yeah. Hey, Joe.
Good. Amazing artist of Amazing Spider-Man since 2002.
Umberto.
Umberto Ramos.
Yeah. Hey, Umberto. And JRJR.
JRJR.
Good.
Well-known Superman artist.
Spider-Man since 1977, including Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut and the Eisner Award-winning Coming Home from 2002, John Romita Jr. Hey, Johnny.
Hi, everyone. How are you?
We're great. All right, so I want to know, for each of you, what is the one thing that you find most distinctive about the design of Spider-Man and particularly drawing him? Joe, why don't you kick us off?
You know, for me, it's always the eyes. It's always Spider-Man's eyes. They're so unbelievably expressive. And I think, considering if you put Spider-Man,
should they be though?
time, it was incredibly unique aspect to his costume, to his look, because you know he was able to emote through the mask. I think that was the most revolutionary thing.
And Joe Q had a good line too about Ditko bringing the creepy, which is fun.
Joe, for you, you know, obviously Steve Ditko has been instrumental in Spider-Man and that initial design.
Well, it's obvious.
Talk a little bit about
Disney's lawyers are listening.
And how it has impacted the character of Spider-Man on the page.
Well, you know, I think the historic drawing.
That maybe.
Set in the panel before us, that you know, there's a creepiness to it that's kind of cool. Right, there's a very, you know, Johnny and I have talked about this a lot. There's a very, as we both, you know, draw Spider-Man and Daredevil, and there's a real big distinction between those two characters, even though they both, you know, leap across rooftops and kind of the same thing, with the exception of sticking out walls and webbing. But Daredevil's more of a gymnast, right? And Spider-Man is just sort of gangly, awkward, bendable kind of figure that is so fun to draw, but both of them take on different aspects. That's what's fun about the Marvel Universe.
All right, favorite Spider-Man costume, Kevin? The original, or do one of the variations catch your fancy?
How can you not go with the original? If you're going to say favorite variation, though, like...
The spider armor?
No, I'm thinking of, like, a character that has a great first one, and then you make a second one, like the black costume being the second one. It's like, how can you luck out like a second time like that?
Yeah, I mean, thought you might go, well,
it's not even a second time. Like they've done it even a third time. Like, how many characters have that many like A+ costumes?
It's true. How about the most influential Spider-Man artist?
Oh, how can you not say Ditko?
Yeah, because John Romita Jr. was sitting on the panel, so somebody had to say Romita Sr.
I mean, I guess so. I mean,
I guess Stan Lee.
Wow. I mean, I guess someone could say Todd McFarlane.
Right? They could.
Based,
but they didn't.
Based the age of the panelists, no one said that.
What keeps bringing you back to this character? I know it's in your blood, but what draws you back?
Yeah, exactly.
See, I did start when I was 2 years old. Just so you don't know, I was drawing early.
this is selfish, and I feel bad about this, but it reminds me of family. From the time my father drove and passed a building and pointed and said that's what they called them. And we were young enough not to understand.
JR, you're making me cry.
I felt like family member. And then my father would discuss stories with us and tell us what Stan was doing this morning at the office to describe the plot, because there was no plot. It was a descriptive plot that my father would take notes on. It was so enveloping that there was more to the character than just the physical artwork of the character. It felt like a family member, and that's what I feel like. I think it's the greatest character. Now, it's a reaction to another great character, but a better version. Listen, it was Superman. It's the antithesis to Superman.
Oh, here you go. Don't forget to check out my Superman run.
Exactly.
It's the sun beat out of him. It's cold. It's cold. Who shrinks in the laundry. This is Stan's antithesis to Superman.
All right. Then the last one that I was able to hang through, at least, was Beyond Ultimate, looking at the other Spider characters in the Spider-Verse. And we had Dan Slott, Carla Pacheco, and Maureen Gu, who spent a lot of her real estate on the panel reminding us that she's not really into comics and doesn't really know comics and doesn't really read comics, but, you know. So they talked about things like what makes a spider character besides just having spider in their name, right? And they said things like, oh, they have heart, you know, or they all goof up, that kind of stuff. But they're rapid-fire questions. Kevin, your favorite other spider character?
I mean, Miguel?
No, the Spider-Mobile, Kevin. You love that thing.
So Spider-Man 2099, huh? That's a good one.
You might go Ghost Spider, Kevin. That's a fun character.
I mean, Spider-Man, that's pretty good, too.
Yeah.
That's pretty fun.
Kevin, say Morbius. Tie into the movie that's coming out soon.
Yeah.
How about which spider character has the coolest costume besides Spidey?
I don't want to use the same answer again.
You could if he's just your favorite, but you know, there is Spider-Gwen. That's a pretty good costume.
Spider-Gwen's pretty great. Yeah, that's a great costume.
Yep. Ghost Spider, guys. I believe it's Ghost Spider.
I believe it's Spider-Woman. She goes by Spider-Woman.
We'll see in the next series what they come out with.
And I have to ask it before we run out of time, which is, if Thwip was banned, what onomatopoeia would you use instead?
Sheep.
Sheep?
Sheep.
I'm trying
to make it like
W-E-H-H-B. Like, oh, that's nice. I appreciate that.
Just that.
Yeah.
How about zip? Zip, 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 zip. Zip, 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 zip.
Actually, I kind of like the web one too, though. Weave, web.
You got to have one E. If you're going to lengthen it at all, don't add extra E's.
Add the extra
E. You get the weeb.
Weeb.
So it starts sounding like a game show host.
All right, and the last rapid-fire question, Kevin, is if Thwip was banned, what onomatopoeia would you use for Spider-Man using his web shooters?
I mean, Thwap, but you'd probably get sued by the league. Because they'd be like, well, that's too close to the other one, and then you'd end up spending, like, I don't know, $4 million.
So
I was trying to do a whole Defiant riff.
The last piece of the pie here was Beyond Amazing, which looked at the future of Spider-Man and had just two guests, C.B. Cebulski and editor Nick Lowe. This is when I had to tap out. Andrew, you could tell me if I miss anything great, but I assume that they were talking about what's next for Spidey, because this last Nick Spencer series ran its course through Spencer's run and then beyond. See what I did there?
I'll be honest, Steve, I actually tapped out. I lasted longer than you did, but even I was like, this is really going. And also, that's kind of the what I'm less interested. Like, those books will come out and I don't really need the hype. Like, I'll either read them or I'm not. There's nothing they're going to say that's going to be like, well, I wasn't going to read it until C.B. Cebulski said it's a good comic book or whatever. You know, like, there isn't that sort of hype that I needed. But,
well, they might show you a picture of Mary Jane walking away or something and say, oh, you have to see this. And then I'd be like, I don't know, guys. That's not great promo.
No, they need him putting his outfit in a trash can. That would be a fresh, hot take. Oh, and they did splash the new toy from Hasbro was coming out the next day. So you could jump on that. Amazon and get I think a new Silk figure. Oh, I don't.
Right, right.
I'm not tracking down all these. That's for you young people to
Isn't
run
that like
down.
The third all. Silk, then?
I want to see the homage cover where it has Spider-Man walking down the alleyway, but it's Mary Jane that he's thrown in the trash can, and she's got like a little steam tornado like coming up from her head, like she's pissed.
I have a great like Archie. You know, he was walking up and down the what is it, the Street of Memories, whatever that thing is, and you know, you get a different series. So I want to see the one where he's walking into the alleyway and taking the, or not, maybe not him, maybe someone else.
Oh.
But they're walking into the alley and they're taking the costume out of the trash can.
Don Blake walking in an alleyway discovers. But thinking of that, this last Spider-Man title, I know it ended kind of weird with this whole Ben Reilly Beyond stuff, but the Nick Spencer run that made up the title, it kind of served its purpose, right? As far as like being a palate cleanser from the Superior Spider-Man stuff and the Dan Slott stuff and the One More Day, Brand New Day kind of stuff.
I guess.
Did our palate need to be cleansed, Steve?
Yeah, kind of, because it was hard to top that Sinister stuff. They had trouble ending it themselves because it was so good, right? I mean, they even did a whole nother Spider-Verse event kind of surrounding the Superior Spider-Man. So, I don't know. I was kind of feeling like that was they struck gold there, and they had to do something that didn't seem like it. You know, you can do the Miller Daredevil for a really long time, but it, you know, then it just becomes the status quo forever, and I like that they tried to change things up and make it however fresh they thought they were making it, as far as the look of the book, the whole title surrounded around that Kindred character, basically, is the ongoing long-running arc, right? I mean, and yes, his name was a clue after all, right? But anyway, it's come and gone, and we'll see what's next, right?
Yeah, well, the funny thing is they'll want me to remember Kindred from that title, but what I'll remember is stuff like, oh, remember the Beetle and all those women got together and they had, like, a dental plan and all that stuff, and they had their own shop and everything? Like, I'll remember, like, the cool stuff like that I enjoyed. Remember Boomerang was hanging out in his apartment and weird stuff was going on? I don't really want to remember the Kindred stuff anymore.
I like the arc where they had the rich people in Central Park hunting all the Spider-Man villains that are animal-based. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, that was weird. Great. You know, that's probably better than some of the later stories now.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. And then I remember, oh, the Sin Eater thing, this is going to go somewhere. And he's going to, I don't know, just kind of there.
You got a lot of point one issues in there. That's what the Sin Eater brought you.
give it up.
Beyond point one issues. The next 60 years of Spider-Man.
Well, they need to do, first, Steve, they need to do Old Man point one and then Death of point one. Or wait, maybe reverse that.
Point one Alpha, point one Omega.
Oh, my joke.
All right, I've got Andrew the L.A. Rabbit here. I've got WWX Kevin here, and it's time for us to hit our third installment covering writer Chuck Dixon's run on Mark Spector Moon Knight, the 90s Moon Knight title, the second one that lasted.
I'm getting on my white tuxedo.
not yet.
Wait.
It's a balmy 97 here, Steve, so I'm pretty excited to read some cool comics.
It's a balmy 7.
Nice. This time we've got issues 15 through 21, which ran from April to October of 1990. But first, as fresh as today's headlines, the new Marvel Studios Moon Knight television series has dropped on the Disney Plus streaming service, and two episodes are out as of this recording, and I saw them. Kevin saw the first episode. Andrew hasn't seen them yet, so I'll be careful to dance around any real particulars, but Kevin, what do you think of the first episode?
I enjoyed it. I mean, it was maybe weirder than I thought they would go, but I guess that helps distinguish it by the way they went about it in the first episode. But I'm sure I'll be proven wrong later on, but I'm like, I hope they pack more stuff into the, because they don't have like 20 episodes to get out there, I assume. Right.
But they
so did... like I think they got to pick up the pace after the first one.
Yeah, 6 episodes to do an origin story when, you know, a movie is usually like 2 hours and each of these episodes is almost an hour is that's long form right there. But I got to say, Hank Azaria is really terrific as, just kidding. the actor, though, he's really good. And I think the way he delivers his lines, he'd be great in like a Woody Allen movie as the Woody character, like delivering the nervous, fast dialogue and making little quips under his voice that are timed right so that they don't seem like he's delivering written lines. That guy, he's real natural in his nervous energy and stuff.
And it's like how he's like, oh no. And then like something happens, like, you know, how they structure things in the episode, and then he's like, oh no.
Yeah, I mean, and he's really convincing and he's really good, but I don't know if I'm digging like a trembling, victimized Stephen Grant character, though. I mean, this is such a different setup and such a different departure in the way they're handling the, are they going to do the whole multiple personality mental illnessy thing, or are they going to grow up? They do a whole different thing that seems more like it's a possession situation, like a Rick Jones, Captain Marvel switching personas, sharing the same body kind of thing. It's very strange. And the Moon Knight design, you see it at the very end of the first episode. It's really cool, but you know, it's pretty much an over design, right? I mean, there's a lot going on that costume.
Yeah, I don't mind it that much. Like, it looks fine. It kind of reminds me of Daredevil in a way with the whole, hey, we're not gonna get to some stuff like right away, which I assume they'll get to, but who knows that the entirety of this take is gonna be.
Andrew, you know, I feel like they always feel like they have to put their stamp on it and do something different just for the sake of doing something different. But when you see these, I almost think that the simpler origin and the simpler costume that we know from the comic books actually would translate more easily in set design and costume design and in storytelling ability into the cinematic experience. It's interesting. It's a totally different take, and it's clever, and it's interesting, and it's engaging, and the actors are really good, but it's just very different.
Yeah. Well, I think they want to do some of the, like modern take and some of that stuff. So I like all that stuff, but I also hope that we get some classic stuff with the new stuff too. I mean, there's one thing that shows up and I was just like, yeah, but I also want to see some street level Jake Lockley cabman action type of stuff too.
You like in the second episode, there's a scene of him like parkouring through the city that is really cool. And suggests that, you know, they could do a pretty cool street level type character. And the threat as it is introduced and the mission that needs to be undertaken are cool. They're solid. And the bad guy, Ethan Hawke, he's a very good actor, right? I mean, he again, those dramatic scenes really feel like something serious is going on. But I mean, it's just weird. It's set in London. It's just different. We'll see where it goes. But
yeah,
anyway. I always feel like Moon Knight is a popular character, but just because most of us read a various run or two or a couple issues, it's a great design, a fun, easily grasped concept. But the character's been through so many pretty different interpretations. I feel like for a lot of people, I'm sure they were like, hey, he's kind of a blank slate, you know?
Yeah.
Sort of like the Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever. Like, yeah, a couple of hardcore nerds are going to get worked up, but generally we can take and do with him what we need as long as it's cool. It's not like there's some, Death of Phoenix or,
right,
you know, Elektra or some key storyline that everyone's going to get really spazzed out about if we don't incorporated into this thing.
I mean, you know, I've often discussed how there's a certain section of fandom that knows specifically what they want about Moon Knight. So, well, I don't know if we'll see some of that translate. I also find it weird when it shows, you know, they show the credits at the end of the episode and say special thanks to, and then they mention a bunch of comic creators. It's like Declan Shelby is mentioned, but Warren Ellis isn't mentioned, and I'm like, that's kind of strange. I guess that's because he's on the outs, but it's just weird after watching that first episode. I'm like, shouldn't they have mentioned the whole Grail team?
Well, maybe they feel they're more stealing from the design sensibilities or the visuals than the storyline.
Yeah, we'll have to talk after Mr. Knight makes his appearance, Kevin.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be interesting now that they can just grab these guys that, like I said, have a following or whatever, but aren't the most consistent in the world. I mean, I think, Steve, you and I have discussed we maybe like more of the regular Moon Knight. I don't know. Or do you like the more crazy, doesn't know what's going on Moon Knight with the multiple personalities and all that?
No, you know my stance. I liked it when it was all a great way to hide his money and to get away from the past that he was trying to escape. He was trying to be everything but Mark Spector, the Soldier of Fortune, and trying to erase the connections to that. I mean, Marlene called him Steven for that whole first series because he didn't want to be called Spectre, and she liked him better that way. And the Jake Lockley thing was his way to be a rich guy on the street and still be able to hang out with people and get the on-the-street information, you know? I liked it all when it was roles that were conveniences and that it was all being run by a clever dude. Not so much the whole Sybil thing.
and the moon copter. I mean, come on, that thing's cool.
Of course.
Oh yeah, Frenchie.
Yeah, the Frenchie, big time. I saw that, and I can't remember which episode it was of those first two episodes, but they go through a flip phone and go through all who all the calls are from, and they're all from the same person, except for one says it's from Duchamp, and that's Frenchie's last name. Dun, dun, dun.
It'd be better if it just said Frenchie, Steve.
Yeah, it would be better. But makes me think maybe they're not going to do anything with it, and it's just like was there as an Easter egg, you know?
Yeah,
that'd be disappointing.
He can come in season two or whatever, you know, or yeah, maybe he's got to bail him out or something.
All right. So since you mentioned him escaping his past as Mark Spector, I mean, that's really what this whole series is about, because Spector's been a mercenary soldier of fortune. He's been a costumed vigilante, a cab driver, a Bruce Wayne-like philanthropist, an avatar, Fist of an Egyptian god, and even an Avenger. Well, a West Coast Avenger. And now he's simply Mark Spector by day and Moon Knight by night. And there's plenty of history and baggage from both his mercenary days and his earlier exploits as Moon Knight to keep him busy and to keep this series cruising along with that as the status quo. He's dealt with his old mercenary boss Bushman twice now, an all-new arsenal, a zombie threat involving Brother Voodoo, and the legacy of one of his old foes, the Midnight Man, whose son Jeff has inserted himself into Spectre's life, kind of advocating for himself to be Moon Knight's partner or sidekick instead of being a thief like his old man was. Frenchy, his old comrade in arms, is back as his pilot, and his off and on again Girl Friday Marlene is back too, and the scantily clad maid cook rehab therapist Chloe rounds out the cast here. That's pretty much the status quo as issue 15 opens.
I've forgotten she was also the cook in the rehab. A natural set. Look, meat's meat, right, Steve?
We needs a carpenter. Who can fix this window? Oh, Chloe, she's good at that. She can do whatever. And all seven of these issues, 15 through 21, are written by Chuck Dixon with art by Sal Velluto and Tom Palmer. 15 to 18 is the trial of Mark Spector, where Spector's past comes back to haunt him as he's put on trial for his actions as a mercenary during a civil war in a South American country, Bosque Verde, many years ago.
Kevin, did you get out your atlas?
Changed forever.
to look up the country. I know you love these fake Marvel countries.
They're always in South America. In issue 15, Mark Spector is brought in and extradited to Bosque Verde. They fly in over Bosque Verde? No, I'll never be over Bosque Verde. And, you know, you can't just serve a guy like Spector his papers, though, Kevin. You got to hire operatives to bring him in, right?
Apparently you hire someone that looks like Marlene in Silver Sable's outfit.
This is 90s like, Marvel.
I would say normally, you know, you keep with the coloring and everything that was done back then, but man, I hope they would fix that.
Well, the part that killed me is she gives her opening like pitch to the teat to the wild pack in what looks like a bathrobe or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, like, I was like, a very scantily colored, I know it's a dark room and everything, but I'm like, what is she wearing?
She's like the Hugh Hefner of Romania or wherever her, whatever her country is. But, you know, this is the perfect job for Silver Sable and the Wild Pack. It's what they do, right? They apprehend these war criminals. The issue opens and Spectre's exhausted because Marlene wants him to rest, but he's got to check in on a few things at the office and promptly falls asleep when he gets there. And when he wakes up, it's nighttime. And the building is cleared out, except for the cleaning lady and a team of armed commandos who are after Spectre.
I like it when the Wild Pack gets their personalities. Here, you don't have enough. I mean, the Sandman gets one, but normally they have like a real colorful cast of weirdos. Yeah. And here, they're just generic Wild Pack goons, except for Sandman and Paladin.
Spectre does his best to evade them and fight them off, despite not being in costume or having any of his gear. And when Sandman makes his entrance, it's like, yikes. That's a tough addition to the mix. And then
Paladin... pull out some water, Steve.
Yeah,
he does a vacuum.
The old fire hose trick. I could make him into concrete. And then the paladin too.
Turn into glass.
And Silver Sable herself is there, and Spectre still manages to stay one step ahead of them, but on the last page he simply gives himself up, because I mean he successfully gives him the slip, but then after he hears what this is all about, he just decides to answer the music.
Maybe it was Silver Sable's plan to look like Marlene, and that would sort of catch Spectre off guard.
Caught my eye. Caught yours as well.
It's a, like, the faces and everything are well rendered. It's a fun. I'm pleased with the art team. Look, I mean, 90s, the coloring's going to be what the coloring's going to be, but it doesn't bother me. I mean, I can get if you didn't read comics back then, so don't go expecting your fancy new coloring, but it works.
No, well, I feel like if you were reading a Hellboy or something, like, you'd get this pretty much the same coloring.
That's big words. You're talking Dave Johnson there. And also, oh, Jeff, the Midnight Man's son, Midnight, calls Spectre and tells him that, hey, don't worry, Mark, you're off the hook. I don't want to be your partner anymore. But Spectre can't see that he's dressed as Moon Knight while he's telling him this.
Yeah, and then I'm like, so he's going to get framed?
Yeah. I was thinking more of Kraven's Last Hunt.
Oh, yeah, that too.
So Spectre knows he's actually guilty of helping a dude who was a brutal dictator take power. He wasn't a brutal dictator before, but he became one once he took power as, you know, those South American puppet leaders will do.
Well, also he makes it clear that he didn't, you know, back then he was just working for money. He didn't make exhaustive inquiries into the character of his employers or anything. Like, he's a hired gun.
Now the problem is there's been another rebellion, and Raposa, the evil dictator that Spectre helped take power, and everyone who supported him are being sought after for war crimes, including soldier-for-hire folk like Spectre. And it gets worse, because Spectre was the one who actually shot the former president before Raposa, and that slain leader's widow, who witnessed Spectre killing him, is the now president's right-hand man, or gal.
We can call her the Baroness, right?
Well, yeah, it's revealed that she's actually pushing the president to do her bidding. She's the real power behind the office of the president here in Bosca Verde.
I like how you remember, like, all the country names and these characters. I'm just like, it's Joe Dokes and South Fake America Stan.
It's like a Warren Zevon song with all the exotic locations and... Spectre gets thrown in a cell with some of Raposa's men and some of his former comrades in arms, and he feels really guilty about being associated with these thug types, and just decides that he's gonna take it. He's intent on paying his dues.
Well, they make it clear they're bad people. Like, they tortured people. Like, they're not.
Yep.
If you had any question, these are definitely bad, and they don't look particularly contrite. Like, they want to take back over so they can put all their enemies back in prison camps and everything.
In fact,
they're bad people.
They plan on escaping their cell and then going and killing the president, like, immediately. And Spectre's like, not me. I'm not, you know, I'm no longer one of you guys. Also, Marlene and Frenchie take off for Bosca Verde to help Mark. You know, Frenchie's, he's still got some connections down there.
And, of course he does.
And Jeff.
And Frenchie's rehabbed quite nicely, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
In the go-go 80s and 90s comics, injuries tended to last about 3 to 4 issues if they're a side character.
If Chloe was my PT, I'd be like, I'll take another session. And Jeff, Midnight, sees the story about Mark in the paper and now feels... like, even more emboldened to impersonate Moon Knight. And perhaps burgle some riches along the way. You know, it's in his blood.
Well, first he's got to steal the actual Moon Knight costume and equipment. Like, so he's not using the store-bought costume.
Wait,
and on one of the boxes next to him, it had like a costume company on one of the boxes.
Like a Ben Cooper.
That I really liked. And I was like, oh, and then he explains, oh, you know, I went in and stole all the good stuff. So he's not, you know, not like those old Spider-Man comics where it's shrinking when it gets wet.
Yeah, I can see them having Spider-Man costumes, but a Moon Knight costume?
They used to be able to tell it was a Spider-Man costume because it would show, like, the pupils.
Yeah.
The cover for issue 17, which depicts Moon Knight with a crossbow being shot at by the Secret Empire's Council of Nine, is notably drawn by John Romita, Sal Velluto, and Tom Palmer. And I don't know if it's a kind of a thing where Romita, after the fact, changed or added some elements, which he would do in his role as art director at the time, but maybe he did something so drastic that it was worth adding his name to the mix, or if he laid it out because his name comes first and theirs follow. I don't know. Can only speculate.
And Chris Ivey also helps out Tom Palmer on this one.
And it turns out that actually on the cover, it's not Moon Knight at all. It's Jeff Midnight dressed up as Moon Knight.
You know, every time you say Jeff, I keep on thinking not the shark.
I know. I did too. And Midnight plans to do some burgling, but instead, through a skylight, witnesses a meeting of the Secret Empire's Council of Nine. Robes, Roman numerals, and all.
Yeah, that can't be good.
The Secret Empire. I mean, I'm all for these Hydras and AIMs and everything, but this one, it never got me. Always seemed like a bit of a Z-fest. Guys, sell me on the Secret Empire. Why are they better than the rest of them?
Well, I don't know if you read that original story. That was kind of their claim to fame.
They were a knockoff. They were like a splinter group of Hydra that was just supposed to take the heat off of Hydra and by being like this fake group that, you know, would take the attention of the hero so Hydra could do their thing. And it wasn't until after Strucker, I think, left Hydra that the Secret Empire became their own thing, like under Englehart.
Yeah, I like their table, too, that where they just have that whole map there, and a guy is like pointing it out, like he has all the stuff on the map, and he likes pushing around like the figures and everything. This is where we're gonna attack, gentlemen.
I feel the outfits are kind of boring, the name's a little dreary. Yeah, I just feel like out of all these groups, like, I never bought into the Secret Empire that much. Although the Roman numerals on them is kind of funny in a way too, like, but it makes sense they're gonna call them. But wouldn't they just recognize each other, like, by their height and voice and all that stuff? Like, do they need the, oh, number two, I thought you were number four. Sorry, I didn't notice your number on you or whatever. You
know? I like how
they're not going to do a whole prisoner bit.
I like how they are satire a bit on, like, the lodge type. Like they say, they've got locations that people just think that they're going to the lodge, but it's really the Secret Empire.
And I like how their guards are equipped with guns and hot dogs.
Yep. Gotta have hot dogs.
They're gonna beat Moon Knight with.
You never know when you need a hot dog. Now, Jeff gets caught observing the Secret Empire's meeting, of course, because he's an amateur. But he does make a successful escape, except now Moon Knight's at the top of their list of targets to strike, which sets up the next arc in issues 19 to 21.
You know what also makes these issues exciting? We have double page spread of comics here for Bonk's Adventure. And the next one, it's like a splatterhouse. Like, video game ads are like peak content in here.
Oh, yeah.
Soon it'll be trading card ads, Kevin. But you're
I know, I looked
that.
At that one. And they even have one an ad for Deathlok in here, too. The one with the spine and everything. And I'm like, looking that up.
That's a good issue.
Yeah.
With the Butch Geist cover. or no, Joe Jusco or Joe Jusco
yeah,
cover
like
and
from a trading card or
Butch
something.
Butch Geist interior, I think.
Yeah, just it looks different.
All right. Meanwhile, in Bosque Verde, Frenchie and Marlene's meeting in the jungle goes bad, and they end up having to shoot their way out.
Well, we have enough story. Like, it's kind of fun. I'm nostalgic for this era of compression, but I can certainly see the complaint if you read a lot of modern books that we're going to see a lot of kind of people shift positions quickly, fairly quickly, because of just the pace that the story's told. Yep. So that part I can see people not liking, but I'm fine with the quick, like he's convinced he wants to take his punishment, but then when he recalls the specifics of the event, something doesn't feel right, so he's going to change his position and all that.
Yeah, I mean, Spectre's trial is a public circus, and he can't stand to see the victims being paraded out of war and everything, and, you know, all through it, he's forgetting the lesson that the victims of war that are there, they were symbolized in that moment when Marlene's father was killed by Bushmen, and it was the catalyst for him to dissent, which then he got killed by Bushmen for, which then he got resurrected by Khonshu for, and then as Moon Knight he makes amends. So he's done good since, and he shouldn't let it get him down.
Yeah, don't let a few war crimes get you down, kids. Remember that.
But
you can always beat up smuggers afterwards to make up for it.
But like you said, in that moment where he killed the president was reaching for something when Spectre's teammate yelled for him to shoot. And was it a gun? We don't know. And then why did the president's widow have a little impromptu meeting with Spectre's comrade in arms afterwards? And what was discussed there? That was... Either way, the trial concludes Spectre and all of the accused are guilty, and they're going to be executed in 3 days. But now when the bad guys are talking about escaping, the prisoners... Now Spectre is remembering there's something fishy here, and now he wants to escape with them.
Oh, sure. Now he wants to join them, Steve. Well, now that it's cool to escape prison.
Well, something's up with it, because his lawyer was a bumbling fool, but he asked the self-defense question, and the widow handled it so poorly that it sort of sprung Spectre into action, like that there's a chink in the armor here, and there's an angle. And there's something she's hiding, and now he wants to know. So one bribed guard later, and the accused escape their cell. Spectre hates being put in with these thugs, and he even prevents them from killing a guard on the way out. But as soon as they're off the prison grounds, they, like, throw him overboard, basically, into a ditch.
Yeah, a beautiful cover on this one, too, by the way. I like the Mark Spector staring through a hangman noose.
And the accused, now that they've escaped, they're going to go kill the president. The new president.
I mean, of course.
But Frenchie and Marlene were casing out the prison. Good old Deus Ex Frenchie again. And they witness the escape and are able to rescue Mark. And then go on this whole gun-toting car chase as they make their getaway, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, it looks like a convertible Volkswagen Bug, like Herbie the Love Bug or something, is in a firefight.
This is the early 90s. There's still some of those on the road, survived from, especially in South America. Marlene gives Mark his Moon Knight suit. And Mark takes off and fights his way into the president's compound, right into his office, where he interrupts the assassination attempt, puts down his former cellmates for good. I bet you that felt good.
I find it funny that they gave a full-page splash in this issue, and then it's from behind. It's like, what?
Yeah, that is weird.
Strange choice.
All I know, gentlemen, is if I'm ever in a really hot, humid jungle, I want a full superhero suit to change into. I'm sure it's moisture wicking, right, Steve?
Right.
Is that the key?
It's the smart wool. Moon Knight then appeals to the new president with a deal. Pardon Spectre, and I promise I'll get Raposa, that former brutal dictator that the new president just overthrew. And I'll get Raposa and his men and I'll deliver them to you. And he reveals his identity to him as Spectre and then disappears. Returning to his cell, even, to see the outcome through, whatever it might be. Although Frenchie and Marlene have their own plan B in mind that involves a lot of grenades. Like three boxes full.
Three boxes.
So on the day of his execution, the president has Spectre stand up and take his turn, but the president pardons Spectre, much to the surprise of the crowd and the Madam Widow Lady. And the issue ends with her praying before the Blessed Virgin statue, saying that she and her husband did what they had to do, even though it meant betraying their country. And it's like, wait, what? And Dixon leaves us with a little tease that, you know, we'll find out eventually there's more to this story.
Huh.
And then that scene gets juxtaposed visually with Spectre, Frenchie, and Marlene back home, basically drinking hot cocoa at the foot of Khonshu's statue. And I don't know, Mark seemed a little smug. I mean, he just got home and almost killed, and he made this whole deal to get out of it and everything, and he's like, yeah, I'll probably have to find that Raposa guy eventually, you know, at some point.
when he feels like it.
Yeah, it didn't seem like it was high on the list.
Well, he's got to, you know, get the finance of his company back. He's got to get a new moon copter. Like, there's things he's got to do, Steve.
Get Khonshu makes some good hot chocolate.
Khonshu's shaft is a great little stirring rod for the hot chocolate.
Yes.
You know, he only eats cookies that are like crescent shaped too, and crescent rolls.
If you leave,
like, all his food.
Another croissant? Must you? Issues 19 and 20.
Half moons.
Half moons. Issues 19 to 21 are the three-part Spidey, Punisher, Moon Knight team-up versus the Secret Empire.
Okay, I have a question. How many extra issues do you think they sold by having Wolverine's logo on the cover for he's not in this issue?
I like that it's a live bell, but we get Spider-Man's feet, so it's haters.
It's so 90s, though. You know what I did immediately when I saw this cover? I was just like, I wonder how close this is to that Amazing Spider-Man story with the Secret Empire.
That's funny.
And that story happens within a year of this story.
There you go. Yeah, the covers for these three issues are not done by the series regulars or the interior artists. They're done by Rob Liefeld, Butch Geis, and Dennis Cohen. And all three are pretty bad.
All yeah, three I'm taking the interior different. Taking the interior art team over Rob Liefeld. No offense, Rob, but, you know, I want to see some faces and some bodies that look at least vaguely human.
And I love Butch Geis, but that it's an awful cover. Awful. And the third one by Dennis Cohen is probably the best of the three, and it's not so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway. And it's the Headband Punisher, too.
I like some Headband Punisher. I know some people don't, but, you know.
Well, do you like his glowing pin eyes, Kevin?
Well, I was actually looking at his belt. I'm like, that's a pretty giant belt. Like, compared to like a normal belt, he can probably fit three times the amount of ammo or whatever into there.
It's to protect his back. It's a lifting belt.
Remember the belt?
If you lean forward, you might be hurting your chest or your abdomen or whatever there.
Remember the teeth of the skull on his chest symbol used to be the double row of bullets on his belt. So he used to have a wide belt.
I don't think it's this wide, though, Steve.
Yeah, this is the super wide when you need to kill extra people model.
Well, this arc opens. The Secret Empire wants Moon Knight like the Illinois Nazis wanted Jake and Elwood Blues back in the Blues Brothers. And they've got all their operatives out looking for him. At home, Spectre learns that he's been robbed. But only
burgled.
Only of Moon Knight gear, though.
Uh-oh.
and the clock is frozen at midnight. Jeff!
Well, to be fair, what other stuff do you want to take his tacky Egyptian tchotchkes? No, you want the Moon Knight kit.
Moon Knight and Frenchie can track Jeff via a tracer in the suit. And they've got this tricked out government copter to use until the new moon copter is ready.
Also, I am Captain Planet, Captain Planet.
I like the exchange, too, of Frenchie bragging about how he added all his weaponry to the copter. And Spectre's like, we're going to be, like, flying around town in a gunship? And they kind of just both look at each other like, yeah, I guess. Cut to the Punisher wearing his headband and needing a shave. He shows up
been busy.
For 6 months he's been busy tracking the Secret Empire, and he shows up at their meeting place, and it's the spot that Midnight as Moon Knight interrupted, and they're gone. Jeff!
Well, he looks good. Like, I think this team does a good Punisher.
Definitely. Tom Palmer does. But, gritty.
You know, he looks regular, like a muscular, lean guy, regularly proportioned. Like, his legs aren't three times longer than his body or anything. Yeah, really, really strong. That would have been a fine cover, this, you know, half page where he's, you know, crouched down looking at the clues.
Speaking of Midnight as Moon Knight, Jeff's off on another caper to prove how badass he is, because, you know, the last one went so well. And this time, it doesn't go much better, because he's spotted and interrupted by Spider-Man.
Oh, no.
I thought Dixon does a fun Spider-Man banter, because I was not impressed with his Jeff and Moon Knight banter. But I thought he did a pretty good... I guess every writer's probably got a bit of Spider-Man quips in him, but I thought it was... Well, after, like I said, I was unpleased with that other bits.
Midnight as Moon Knight tries to escape with Spidey in pursuit, and then they suddenly both start getting shot at by the Secret Empire from one of their flying party boat things.
Yeah, one of them looks like a disc, and then the other one looks like almost like the Fantastic Four's bathtub.
And in their...
The disc is more like a flying V, perhaps, Kevin, if you remember a certain Thunderbolt who used to stand on top of it.
You can't go inside it?
Well, don't forget, they landed a flying saucer on the White House lawn back in the day. That was one of the Secret Empire's big moments. But their little flying party boat things are one of the coolest things about the Secret Empire, that there could be these robed guys with the Roman numerals on their head just flying around on these little... bathtubs is awesome. That's a great visual. I love
The coolest thing is watching Spider-Man beat him up.
Eventually, the real Moon Knight arrives on the scene and drops down on the main platform ship. Midnight as Moon Knight throws a bit of a hissy fit at Spider-Man about not needing help. Then he jumps onto the hull of Frenchie's copter, hanging onto the exterior, and asks for help to bring him over to where the real Moon Knight's fighting.
But I thought it was a smart choice that he takes his full hood off, so we're clear at all times who is who.
Yep.
Smart choice, everybody. I approve. Normally, we like superheroes keeping their kit on, but in this case, well done.
Moon Knight is holding his own fighting, but Jeff bounds in and takes a seemingly lethal blast meant for Moon Knight. No!
Oh!
Not like
this. Well, I'm sure he won't regret it.
Spidey saves Moon Knight from a fall overboard, and the Empire escapes with Midnight. Moon Knight and Spidey agree that they'll help rescue him, and then the Punisher shows up.
I thought it would be funny if he never caught up with them and just... That was his only appearance was earlier on.
Or working in the shadows.
Yeah, and you never see him the rest of it. Like, he was chasing a different group of the Secret Empire.
Like his in Walt Simonson and Art Adams' New Fantastic Four, where he just makes that one little side appearance to blow that one thing up and then take off. Spidey actually has to break up Moon Knight and the Punisher from being in each other's faces, because, I mean, let's face it, the Punisher and his methods represent behavior that Spectre is trying to make amends for, right?
Yeah, he might want to talk to Frenchie about that, by the way.
Yeah.
That dude likes his guns.
They track the Tracer and Jeff's cowl to an old car junkyard in Jersey. And there are defenses. Squads of commandos, in fact. It takes our trio...
I think they should have had junkyard dogs, Steve. Wouldn't that have been funny? Yeah. Like robotic junkyard dogs or something that were camouflaged.
It takes our trio 5 pages to cut through the troops. Also, Jeff is shown to be horribly injured with scarring over the majority of his body, but he is still alive.
Does he become Doctor Doom?
The Secret Empire know that Jeff's not the real Moon Knight now, but they still have plans for him and move him to another experimental facility.
Oh.
Then they threaten Number 6 because he messed everything up, so he's got to kill the superheroes or it'll be his neck on the line.
Yep.
Oh, I thought he'll become Number 7.
He's the scapegoat for sure. Moon Knight and Spidey then have to fight an armored mech suit guy that has a chainsaw limb attachment, Kevin. Bzzz.
Like, were they watching? Is it Alien or?
It's the second one, I think.
Yeah, Aliens. I was thinking, isn't there something like that?
Where she has that mech suit. Maybe it's the first one, but I know in the second one, I think, too, or one of them. Yeah, she's got the giant hydraulic robot suit, which is what you want against fast guys. You want the big, slow, clunky robot machine.
The hovering platform ship thing of the Secret Empire gets in a dogfight with Frenchie, and actually they manage to blow Frenchie out of the sky, but this time he makes a softer landing.
Well, that's good. You don't want him to go through that physical therapy again.
The Punisher, though, with a ground-to-air missile, blows the hovercraft out of the sky. But Jeff is in a makeshift ambulance, and they manage to escape with him after all. Number 6, though, you got to give him credit, because he actually does a pretty good job against Spider-Man and Moon Knight. He gets a couple of knife wounds in on Moon Knight and zaps Spider-Man pretty good. Unfortunately, they chase him into a vehicle grinder. And Moon Knight threatens him and gets the info he wants, and then the Punisher wanders on scene and throws the switch. It just crushes Number 6 up into like 3 number 2s.
Yeah, nice panel too with the Punisher in silhouette except for the skull chest.
Yeah,
as you know, you hear all the sound effects of the guy getting stuck in the hydraulic press.
So that guy is going to really hate the Punisher then.
Yeah. Well, it's like Jigsaw, except his whole body was crushed.
Yeah, Spidey and Moon Knight aren't too thrilled with the Punisher after that movie either, though. Now, issue 21 opens up with Moon Knight, Spider-Man, and the Punisher ambushing the Secret Empire's inner circle on their floating airship platform thingy. And I love how it has rails so that you don't fall off, but people are always falling off.
Hey, you know people have fallen off, and they're like, well, you know, safety is number one at the Secret Empire. Put some railings on there.
Yep.
That's why you need one of those chains that hook to your belt that you can chain yourself to the railing.
You don't want to be falling into the Sarlacc pit anytime soon. Now, how the group got this intel and headed the Secret Empire off at the pass here is beyond me.
Like, that's what 6 gave up to the Punisher in the last issue. I think we're supposed to guess.
I thought that was the location of the headquarters, not where to get onto a bridge to catch them as they fly by.
Well, maybe they triangulated. If they were here and the base is there, they would take a direct flight there. Mm. I mean, maybe they'll stop at Coney Island, get a hot dog.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Maybe every Sunday they go and stop for groceries. You know,
but you could probably triangulate based on the junkyard's location to the main base and calculate a path.
That sounds hard. the Punisher shoots
What's
down.
What's hard is they had to find a way a path to intersect them where the Punisher could drive his van.
Right, that's what I mean.
Because they can fly.
They literally headed him off at the pass. They got on the bridge, they're flying under the bridge, and now Moon Knight can jump down off the bridge onto the platform. Punisher can shoot a little bit while they're still in range, and then Spider-Man, despite his web shooters, despite his enhanced speed, agility, and strength, completely misses the ship. That was really, that took me out of the story for a second there. I'm like, what? That was a little too convenient, but you're on your own, Moon Knight, which is the point.
Hey, Moon Knight beat up, eluded the Wild Pack, Silver Sable, Paladin, and Sandman. We're taking some liberties with who we're betting on.
You know, Spider-Man swinging off of a bridge can't land on a boat, or, you know, I don't know. But anyway, Moon Knight fights his way to number one, but gets surprised from behind and knocked off the ship into the river. Kersplash.
Except the river looks surprisingly clean for 1990.
Our heroes regroup, dry off, and get some intel from the Punisher's man, Micro, confirming that location of the Secret Empire. And at that location, Jeff awakens. He's horribly scarred. Locked in a room with a nurse who was abducted, but basically is going to do her duty and care for this patient.
And you get their little speech about how they're going to use him and manipulate him, blah, blah. And they have their fists clenched and all the chew scenery, etc.
Yeah.
She kind of has an interesting hairdo here with like sort of a half owl thing going on.
Number one wants to make Jeff into a killing machine to thwart the costumed heroes that keep interfering. I mean, this happens too much. They need something, firepower, to go up against these costumed heroes. So this is their opportunity.
Yeah, except we've seen Jeff's skill level, and it's maybe not at that take on superpowered.
Well, stay tuned, true believer. And then number one also feels pressured to rush their timeline and launch this predatory rocket that they had plans to launch, but they're going to do it tonight. And it's a satellite that can kind of pirate other satellites so they can hold other communication satellites hostage.
I think I saw that in G.I. Joe too. Cobra Commander gets on TV and says he's got a weather dominator or whatever.
I thought it was Austin Powers. Before they raid the Secret Empire's lair, Mark and Frank, Moon Knight and the Punisher, have it out one more time over two pages until Spidey breaks it up. They storm the compound, fight their way to the leaders, and the Punisher kills everybody but number one, who then Moon Knight beats the crap out of. And almost chokes the life out of him, but Spidey intercedes. I mean, he doesn't, like, hold Moon Knight back, but just that he's there and talks to him, Moon Knight makes the, air quotes, right decision.
Again, it's never a crime to kill henchmen, Steve. they're not human, but if they have a name or a number or something, then they're important.
Well, they do technically have a number.
And the issue ends with Jeff's nurse feeding him. He's getting stronger and madder. She mentions Moon Knight, and he's like, Moon Knight, he nearly got me killed. Then he left me for dead, which is how I'll leave him the next time we meet. Dun, dun, dun. So how about that,
in this
Kevin?
Series.
Right? A little round robin prelude?
That's what I'm thinking.
Well, yeah, and how about the fact that the Spidey and the Punisher were here at the beginning of it, so it totally makes sense that they're there and involved when this story develops over in Amazing Spider-Man, right?
Yeah.
And the whole angle of that, if you remember correctly, is that the Secret Empire want to build the ranks of their superhuman commandos here, and the first recruit they send Midnight after is Nova to turn him And that's how it becomes a Nova, Night Thrasher, Moon Knight, Punisher crossover over an Amazing Spider-Man in a during a, that summer, and it went bi-weekly.
Yeah.
No, semi-weekly. Right? No,
bi-weekly, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah, it went every 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, and then they had that fold-out poster cover.
That when we first suggested reading the series, I was thinking, oh, it'll be cool because Kevin will be able to see the beginning of that round robin thing, because that's a storyline that, although we haven't actually covered on this show, we've mentioned fondly or jokingly many times.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I had no idea that this happened before. That's like, obviously that's in that story, but like, there's no way to access it, and still to this day there is no way to access the prelude to that story.
Yeah, these aren't on the Unlimited yet. But maybe someday, now that Moon Knight's got the TV show, maybe they'll digitize and remaster this stuff and get an omnibus out of it or something, you know?
I'm thinking the next Epic Collection should be this series, right?
Epic series, I'm hoping. I prefer that to the omnibus, I have to say.
Yeah, they're easier to read.
Yeah, those omnibuses, I'm an old man. One of those things falls on me, I'm dead.
But how about this? We got your big hero in the real world story with the trial and your crossover that then leads to an even bigger crossover. It's totally 90s comics here, folks, and it's only 1990.
Yeah, and still, they're not bad.
No.
I'm going to keep on. This is like the reverse. When do the bad issues start?
Later.
I mean, not yet.
That's why my pitch for doing this bit was, let's cover at least Chuck Dixon's run on this title, because we have other big Moon Knight fans who don't look fondly on this run, and I think they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater and forgetting how this series started versus how it ended.
Yeah.
Which was a horror show. A horror show, you guys. Frenchie and Mark are both brothers who were demons separated at birth, and they both die.
What are you talking about?
Son, swear to God.
Now that sounds like 90s comics.
It's awful. It's so bad.
Clones, secret brothers, demons.
Armor. It's bad.
So what you're saying is the artwork is better than the story?
Yes, as things go along.
Please tell me there's unnecessary crossovers too, Steve. That's what we need to finish our 90s trifecta.
Because there was some
I think there's an Infinity type of crossover, isn't it? Where, doesn't he face like a doppelganger of himself that's like a demon or something?
Well, I think we get there, because there ends up being some hobgoblin stuff that's coming up.
Yeah, I know you put Doctor Doom and Hobgoblin in like a Moon Knight title, and right away I'm just like, my ears perk up and I'm like, I gotta see if this is any good.
And next is gonna be the run up to the double-sized issue 25, which should be fun,
where you have another 90s team up, Ghost Rider and Moon Knight.
Dun, dun, dun. Chuck Dixon, Ghost Rider. Fun stuff, right?
For sure.
All right. Hang in there, we'll Andrew.
I got to beat one of us. Normally, I'm the one saying, are you guys going to keep on? And you guys give me a bunch of sass answers. So now I get to hold out.
Enjoy it. Enjoy the role. The curmudgeon role. All right. Until we see number one go number two in the woods, make mine Marvel. Later.
Wow.
The cover of October skies, all the leaves on the trees I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low in all the night's magic. Seems to whisper and hush in all the soft moonlight. Seems to shine in your blush. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, oh my love? Or can I just make some more romance with you, oh my love?